everybody out there in podcast land, and welcome to the Front Row Network, the podcast for people who actually like movies. Today, we bring you a special episode where we're lucky enough to spend some time talking with Academy Award winner Aaron Schneider, who directed the upcoming thriller Greyhound, starring Tom Hanks, which was released on July 10th on Apple TV. Hanks, who also wrote the movie, stars as longtime Navy veteran who, as a first-time captain, is tasked with protecting a convoy of 37 ships, carrying thousands of soldiers and much-needed supplies across the treacherous waters of the Atlantic during World War II. For 5 days with no air cover, the captain and his small force of 3 escort ships must make their way through an area of the ocean known as the Black Pit, battling Nazi U-boats while protecting their invaluable ships and soldiers. Greyhound is inspired by events during the Battle of the Atlantic, which took place in the earliest months of America's alliance with Great Britain and the Allied forces. Stephen Graham, Rob Morgan, and Elizabeth Shue star alongside Hanks. Along with me on this discussion we're about to embark on with the award-winning director are my co-hosts for today, Craig McFarlane and Jeremy Gechner. How's it going, gentlemen?
Going pretty well, Jay. I have to tell you, I need to commend you because I haven't been on a podcast with you since you became a co-host of Flashbacks, and you and Ryan had a killer interview with Captain Dale Dye, which I imagine will come up amongst our interview with Director Schneider here. So we are just so happy to have you as a co-host, and you guys just killed it with that interview.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll echo what Craig said there. And also just say, like, come on, lower the bar for the rest of us a bit, man. Like, you know, like, don't keep doing so well. Like, that makes all of us have to, like, raise our game. And nobody wants to do that nowadays. Nobody.
Yeah, we're watching Greyhound. A rising tide raises all ships, right?
Nicely done. Nicely done. And on that note, what a film. What a film. If you haven't watched it yet, I would dare say get Apple TV just to watch this movie. It's quite fantastic.
Before we get started, we wanted to introduce our listeners to our guest today, Mr. Aaron Schneider. Schneider's first feature, Get Low, drew widespread praise when it premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival and earned Schneider the Independent Spirit Award for Best First Feature. His short film, Two Soldiers, won an Academy Award for Best Live Action Short. Upcoming projects include the heartwarming drama Bums Rush, which and reunites him with the Get Low cast, Robert Duvall and Bill Murray, as well as screenwriter C. Gabby Mitchell. Schneider will direct and produce the film alongside Sarah Green and Mitchell. Bums Rush will star Anne Hathaway as Pearl, a highly skilled custom boot maker whose path crosses the singular stray dog Bum, to be voiced by Bill Murray. These two highly independent individuals find themselves at a serious crossroads, one that will change both their hearts and minds in the way that they can hardly imagine. He began his career as a cinematographer working in commercials and music videos. In 1995, Schneider joined the groundbreaking legal drama Murder One, executive produced by Stephen Bochco. Schneider earned an Emmy Award nomination and won 2 AFSC Awards for his work on the show. In addition to numerous works on television pilots, Schneider went on to lens feature films, including Kiss the Girls, Simon Birch, and the second union for James Cameron, worldwide mega hit Titanic. Born in Springfield, Illinois, and raised in Peoria, Schneider always has an interest in movies and visual effects. Inspired by the works of legendary guest lecturer cinematographers and future mentors Owen Roseman and Conrad Hall, he soon gravitated towards cinematography as an ultimately over to directing. Schneider began his directing career in episodic television, but interested in helming feature films, he decided to self-finance and adapt William Faulkner's short story, Two Soldiers, into a short film. The 40-minute short won a top prize at the Palm Springs Film Festival, which made it eligible for the Oscars. Schneider submitted the film for the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, which led to his Academy Award. Catching sight of host Billy Crystal on stage, he thanked the actor for guiding him through his career, and the two reunited after the show. Just a wonderful biography, and I can't wait to get into this interview.
Yeah, absolutely. This guy is, I'm going to love hearing what this guy has to say.
I want to know what Bums Rush, that looks like a talking dog with Bill Murray.
Right? Sign me up. One.
All right, so we're just going to get right into it.
All right, welcome to the Front Row Network and NPR Community Voices partner. Today, we'd like to welcome Academy Award winner Aaron Schneider, and we're just going to jump into the discussion. So, Aaron, how's everything going for you right now, and especially with the pandemic going on and how that's affecting your work now and in the future?
Yeah, well, it's had a pretty big impact on my life, like anyone else's. It's a really ironic thing to be going through. You know, I'm essentially premiering a film in the middle of a pandemic. It's usually a very celebratory process. You know, everyone's probably heard of the big premiere that a movie would have, and you'd get together in a big theater and reunite with some of the cast and the crew, and it serves often as just kind of a celebration. You become a family when you shoot, and it gives everyone one last chance to sort of get together and celebrate their work. And of course, we weren't able to do that. On the other hand, I'm really grateful, given the state of theaters these days, that we have an audience that we can share it with, because at the end of the day, you make movies for an audience, and audiences are a rare commodity these days.
The pandemic's affected all of us viewers and how we're watching and taking in media now. And while we weren't able to see it in theater, and this definitely was a movie I would have loved to see on the big screen, I was very glad that I had such immediate access. You know, I got three kids, so it's always like a timing effort to get to the theater to see a movie.
You have a good TV? You got a nice big screen across the room there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
And just hope they don't break it again. Again, I want to point out again. that's unfortunate that you didn't get that celebration, but hopefully today we can celebrate a little bit with you on this, because I know we all liked it. But before we get into that, we always ask all first-time guests on the Front Row Network the same question. What's your favorite movie?
Oh, wow. Wow. That's really hard to say. I think someone asked me something similar about a week or two ago, in the form of, if you were on a deserted island, which movie would you want to have with you, right?
Yeah.
Which is, you go, because you have to frame it. Otherwise, you know, there's different favorites for different reasons, right? I think if I was on a deserted island, I'd take The Wizard of Oz with me.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah, that's a great answer. We just over this pandemic stuck at home with my kids. We put up a big screen in the backyard, and for my brother-in-law, loves the movie, we had a family night where we watched Wizard of Oz about a month ago.
There you go.
Absolutely. That's a much better choice than that. But I'll pass the mic over to Jeremy, because I know he's got a question for you.
Yeah, and that response there, Aaron, is exactly why we ask that question every time, because that's about verbatim what everybody always says, like, oh, man. Yes, we all watched Greyhound, and I just absolutely loved it. Just an incredible movie experience that you put together there. But obviously it was supposed to be, it went from a theatrical release to now an Apple TV exclusive release. It's definitely the biggest movie that Apple TV has made as far as blockbuster content for streaming services go. And so ideally, you know, a theatrical release, Tom Hanks with a World War II movie is a pretty known winning combination and such. But is there any relief in having a major streaming service platform have such faith in this movie to make it like its flagship movie? I mean, what are your thoughts on just how that whole entire process happened?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. You know, as a filmmaker, you make a movie, you make the best movie you can, and then you put it in the theater and everyone bites their nails over the weekend, hopes that the weekend is well engineered for the right audience at the right time. And then you wait and hope that the box office comes in where you want. And, you know, we're all familiar with the box office reports, you know, even the news likes to say the box office. I mean, it's become that big a thing. The local news will announce which movie won the box office, right? So it becomes this big rite of passage, you know, and there's a lot of pressure. And with COVID, you know, the films that the films that are kind of waiting to find a home now are kind of like, you know, Christmas shoppers outside the store before it opens. You know, it's bunching up and everyone's standing at the door and pushing and, you know, jostling for position. And they've all got their eyes on one particular weekend once the door opens, you know what I mean? And,
right.
And the doors are eventually going to open, but there's two problems, you know, not everyone can get the slot they want. And, you know, you're going to run out of Cabbage Patch Dolls with Primo Real Estate, you know, you know, to play with that metaphor. And so there's the competition for placement. And then you add to that, that when they do open, more than likely they're going to be at lower capacity so that people can be seated safely. And that cuts essentially the movie theaters, you know, let's say it cuts it in half. So now suddenly we're talking about maybe half the theaters just because we're only filling half the seats. So those two things compound themselves, right? And it becomes a really kind of a scary idea, pushing the movie forward and forward and forward and hoping that you'll find a new home. So absolutely, when Apple came along and showed enthusiasm for the film, you know, as a sort of a flagship feature premiere, it was both flattering and it was also comforting to know that we'd have an audience and a company that would really celebrate it, you know, not just because they enjoy the movie, but because it's in their best business interest to promote it, right?
Absolutely.
So that was the silver lining.
Real quick on that, I don't know if you saw Deadline just posted article showing that of the viewership, 30% were new members to Apple TV this weekend that watched Greyhound, and it's the highest watched or most watched movie on Apple TV to date. So that's some consolation that you can take from it, I'd say.
Absolutely. You know, knowing that you were, your first goal as a filmmaker is to make a movie that lots of people see, that lots of people like. And then your next goal, which is a little more selfish, is that it does good business for the people that are in the business, you know, because that benefits you as a filmmaker, obviously. You know, there's a reason people like James Cameron got to the point where they could make, you know, three movies for $1 billion. It's because over his career, he's made money for people. He's done good business on the business side of the whole industry. The more successful you can be, the more opportunities you get as a filmmaker.
Absolutely. So we are sitting here at our homes in Chatham, Illinois, in Springfield, Illinois. And you were born here. Then you moved to Peoria. And so can you speak to your time in Central Illinois and how that came about, how your drive to become a filmmaker, did it start here while you were in Central Illinois?
It didn't. I was born in Springfield, Memorial Hospital there, and lived in Westchester Boulevard off of Chatham Road. And then about age eight, we moved to Peoria. My dad was with Central Illinois Light Company, and they, I believe, transferred him up there to that office. And then I basically went to junior high and high school in Peoria, but we lived in Dunlap, which was a suburb of Peoria. And then I went to Chillicothe High School, Illinois Valley Central down in Chillicothe. And my Wikipedia page has got me living in Mossville, but that's only because I went to grade school or junior high in Mossville. So I've been, you know, I've been all over Central Illinois throughout my life, and it was a big part of my life. I love to come back. My folks are there in Springfield now, over in a retirement community called Concordia Village, and they're happy as clams. Although, you know, boxed up, you know, obviously the pandemic's been really dangerous for seniors in retirement communities, and so they're taking extra precautions over there and being as safe as they can. But I check in with them on a daily basis and they're doing fine. My dad likes to, you know, he gets frustrated from time to time that he can't jump in his car and head down to Walgreens. But other than that, you know, he's in pretty good shape.
That's really good to hear.
Yeah, but as far as when I got bit by the Hollywood bug, I was in college studying engineering and frustrated with the curriculum. And we were on a family vacation down in Florida. And Billy Crystal was vacationing at the same hotel we were there. He had his daughters and he played volleyball with some people and he was very friendly. And it was either my mom or my dad who said, why don't you go up and ask Billy how to get in the film industry? Because I expressed interest in special effects. I was reading this magazine called CineFX. And I thought naively, hey, they have mechanical effects in movies. Maybe my mechanical engineering degree will lead to an exciting career in mechanical effects in movie making. And so I went up to Billy and told him my story. And he said, you need to go to film school. You'll get a Bachelor of Arts degree, which will make your family happy. But more importantly, you'll be opened up to all the different facets of filmmaking, because there are many, and people move around and they find their niche, and you never know where you're going to end up. And it even kind of changes throughout your life and your career, which of course I didn't really understand at the time, but I took it in because I said, I want to be in special effects. And I applied immediately to USC, got in, transferred, and there was a special effects class waiting for me there. It was the only time that SC had this class, which was ironic. And I took the class, and everyone in the class, they had all the masters, all the Industrial Light and Magic people came to this class to guest lecture. You know, Dennis Muren, Ken Ralston, you know, Phil Tippett, the guy who animates all the creatures in the, everybody. And one by one, they'd all say the same thing, that the future of special effects, visual effects was in computers. And I would like, oh my God, I just got done with computers, right? I just kind of drug myself through Fortran and engineering. I don't want anything to do with computers. I want to be hands-on. So naively, not understanding, you know, just kind of relating computers to busy work, I shifted my interest to cinematography, because they also had this wonderful class where amazing cinematographers would come and show one of their movies. And then the next day the class would set up one shot, one lighting setup from their movie. So we could see the movie and then we could see how this image was created. And they brought in all kinds of legends, Conrad Hall, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Road to Perdition, American Beauty. And they brought in, you know, people like, Owen Roizman, who shot The French Connection and The Exorcist. And these guys would just, you know, and they'd use us as the crew to move lights around and show us how they did things. And I just got bit by the cinematography bug. And of course, graduated, put together a demo reel. And this was when MTV was booming, which created a lot of opportunities for young cinematographers to experiment in music videos. And as you guys probably know, a lot of directors came out of music videos, Fincher and Michael Bay, all those right. guys came out of the generation that ahead of me when I was getting into music videos as a cinematographer. And then from there, you know, I got a big break doing a Stephen Bochco TV show based on a big music video I had done with director F. Gary Gray, actually, who went on to make a bunch of movies. That was a big high profile Cadillac TV show back then, Stephen Bochco's organization. And that won some Emmys and I won some awards, and that led to feature films, Kiss the Girls, Simon Birch. I did some second unit on Titanic. And then I said, you know what? I'd like to make my own film. So I made, adapted Two Soldiers, put my life savings into it. It's a big gamble. And, that was my short film that won the Oscar in 2004. And it wasn't until I was literally running up on stage, you know, after they called our name, a very surreal moment. But I had the presence of mind, and believe it or not, it hadn't occurred to me until just that moment. As I walked up on stage, I look over and there's Billy Crystal. standing there on stage. He's hosting the show, and it hit me that he, you know, that conversation with him is where it all started. And so just kind of spontaneously, I got up to the mic, and the first thing I said was, "Billy, thank you for recommending film school to me so many years ago down in Florida." And then I launched into whatever I had prepared. And he and I kind of reunited at the end and said hello. And it was one of those rare moments in life where it works like the movies, where everything comes full circle.
Absolutely. That's a remarkable story there. It's so amazing that he was up there hosting at the exact time. Like,
I know
you're winning that. That's a movie script, isn't it, right there? So you already talked about kind of how you got into transitioning from director photography. And by the way, also the pilot episode of Supernatural, which my wife and I have been obsessed with for years, mostly because of that pilot episode. So amazing work there as well. Now that you are like pretty firmly here in the director's chair, what would you say your influences are as a filmmaker? Who are the people that you draw on to get inspiration while you're working?
I was a child of the 80s. You know, I was, I still get giddy over movies like E.T. and Back to the Future and Raiders and all that stuff, right? But of course, you grow up and your tastes evolve and the kind of stories you're interested in telling evolve. So I watch more online TV these days than I do movies, because it seems like the streaming space is where all the really unique and interesting stuff is happening.
Absolutely.
And I just eat that stuff up, as much of it as I can. I really enjoy the fact that we're in this golden era in the streaming world. And the kid in me, you know, the sort of the one who looks back at the movies in my earlier life, is thinking about those classic Spielberg, the adventure in your own backyard type of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they all had emotional, you know, an emotional impact on me. They all moved me in different ways. So I think probably if it had any influence, it was an effort to try to make movies that gave an audience a thrill ride, but also an emotional experience of some kind that kind of dripped off them or followed them out the movie theater when the movie was over.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and you can feel that, it's a more serious tone, but you can definitely feel elements of that, in Greyhound. But Greyhound, as you mentioned, wasn't the first boat movie you've worked on. You did a little camera work for a small little independent movie that nobody saw called Titanic.
Right.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask, how did your experience on Titanic prepare you for filming Greyhound, or were they completely different experiences?
They were very different experiences. And, the Titanic experience was fantastic. I had a film school friend who had become a staple at Lightstorm Entertainment, which is Jim Cameron's company. And his big break that year was Jim moving him from sort of a confidant, jack of all trades, build me a theater, you know, go get me something at the store, you know, kind of assistant, to, hey, why don't you do second unit for me on Titanic? So this was my friend's big break. And so he hired me because at the time I had some success in the television space, like I mentioned, and he wanted someone that he could count on, that he knew and trusted. And that's when he invited me down there to photograph what he was, the, you know, his second unit directing. So he would get all kinds of different odd jobs, little, you know, we shot a lot of stuff in the boiler room down there, shoveling coal and people panicking and shutting the dampers when the iceberg appears and trying to escape after they hit the iceberg and water was coming in, that kind of stuff. And so we weren't, you know, they were distinct pieces of the film rather than the whole thing. Right. So when it came time to do Greyhound, there wasn't really anything technical to draw on other than the experience itself, because everything you do teaches you something. But it was fun. I got to, you know, the first day down there, I walked in to the set and got to meet Jim. This is a funny story. I told you about the TV show I did, right? Murder One for Stephen Bochco. So Steve takes me up to meet Jim, who's sitting in his chair, and the set is deadly quiet. Jim's the only guy. It's like, you know how in grade school there were classes that had the teacher that always kept the class quiet, and then other classes were just, well, I've got news for you. You know, Jim's sets are deadly quiet. The only voice you hear is his over a microphone, because the crews are usually so enormous. So it was a little intimidating. Then I walk up to Jim and he goes, "Hey, how's it going?" And I'm like, "Fine." He says, I said, "Nice to meet you." He goes, "Oh, we already met." And I said, "What do you?" I said, "No, I'm sure I would remember that." And he said, "No, you wouldn't. You were so busy." He said, and it turns out that he had visited the set of my TV show with one of our executive producers, Chick Egley, who was a friend of his. And Chick came around to introduce me. And he said, "You were so busy. Jim said you were wrestling with a Kinaflow light on the floor with a grip stand and you couldn't get it undone." And you said, "Yeah, hi, nice to meet you." And then you went back to work. Which I didn't know until that very moment. I'm like, "Oh, geez, you know, sorry." He goes, no, you were working hard. And he says, "Here, let me show you something." And he was like, he's like a little kid. He opened up a box and showed me this piece of equipment he invented that allowed him to look through the camera and sort of emulate what a Steadicam shot would be without a Steadicam, so that his Steadicam operator could see what he was doing vis-a-vis a transmitted image, and then the Steadicam operator could recreate it. Wow. And he called it the vid stick. And it was like a little, you know, it's like your next door neighbor saying, look what I got, you know? Because he's a total geek, techno geek like the rest of us. And so he was very friendly, and then we'd go shoot and we'd videotape the shot, and then we'd run across campus to his set, pop the tape in and get Jim's approval on it. And he'd say things like, "Hey, Aaron, those boilers, they're really black. You might want to pump a little more light into those." And I'd be like, "Yes, sir." And then we'd go back but it was a fun experience. It's great to be a part of such a seminal film. That's the thing in this business. You don't ever know which films are going to end up being Titanic, mm-hmm. right? Everyone credits, you know, when you think about or talk to a filmmaker that's got some big movie credit, I guarantee you none of them knew, right? They didn't know. So you have to be humble in that respect, because you never know what it is you're going to work on that's going to enter the pantheon, or it's just a matter of luck and timing.
You know, so I had the opportunity to watch Two Soldiers recently, and just a remarkable short. It's the boy that plays Willie in that in that short, just a phenomenal little actor. And I know he's not little anymore because it was made in 2004, but just an amazing actor. And you said you sunk your life savings into it. Can you speak a little bit to the process of making Two Soldiers and how that went for you? And then kind of a secondary question as well is that a lot of your films seem to happen around the Great Depression, World War II timeframe. Is there something about that era in particular that speaks to you?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I do have a fondness for, I guess I'm a bit of a time traveler. I like to, you know, I'm a bit sentimental when it comes to my own past and history. So yeah, I think there's probably something there, but there's also a bit of a, inside the industry itself. You know, people tend to look at what you did and compare it to what they're trying to do. So there might be a little bit of like, hey, you know, I know for a fact that one of the reasons the producer hired me on Get Low, my first feature, was because it was low budget period film. And that's what I did with my short, right? So there's a little bit of, I don't want to call it typecasting, but you set the tone for what you like to do and what you did, and then people pick up on that and sometimes run with it. So that could be a part of it. But yeah, the short film, you know, the business is very segmented. You get pigeonholed. And so when I made the decision that I wanted to try my hand at directing, I knew I had to, it's like, you know, how do you change the course of an asteroid? You know, you have to blow up an atom bomb to change it 1 degree, right? The same thing kind of applies to your career in this industry. If you want to change directions, you have to make an explosion and something that'll really alter your course. And so I came up with the concept. Even before I knew what film I was going to do, my concept was, all right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to throw my life savings into a bank account, because no one invests in a short film, because at the time anyway, there wasn't any potential revenue stream for it. They're literally calling cards. And so I knew, you know, the only investment I was going to be making would be in myself and my career. But I was young enough that I was ready to, you know, take a shot. And I checked with my family, because it was a very nerve-wracking decision. And I said, you know, I might need to sleep on your couch for a few years if this doesn't work out. And they were all very supportive, probably used to me growing up through life. I was always trying crazy projects. You know, I was always, I think when I was 7 or 8, I coaxed my next door neighbor into digging a Hogan's Heroes tunnel in the backyard. Right. So I was always project oriented, and this made sense to me. So I looked for a short story to adapt. I was a new screenwriter, so I wanted to use the strength of a short story I could find that moved me, that I could then adapt as a screenwriter rather than building something original. And I had just seen Saving Private Ryan with my dad on a golf outing. We every year we'd play golf on my birthday. And that was on my mind, and I went into the library on the first day to try and find, you know, where do you start? I'm going to make a short film. I'm in a library. Where do you start? So I went to the anthology section, and then I had to figure out what book to pull down. So I'm looking at the spines of these books, and this book catches my eye, olive green cover, and the spine says Greatest World War II American Short Stories. And because of Saving Private Ryan, I said, hey, okay, let's just check this out. You know, I had Saving Private Ryan on the brain. So you pull the book down and, you know, you thumb through it looking for something to browse. And I found, and I landed on this short story in the center of the book called Two Soldiers. And I read the opening sentence, which went something like, me and Pete used to go down to Old Man Killigrew's and listen to the radio, because Old Man Killigrew's wife was deaf. And so she run the radio as loud as it would run. And so me and Pete could hear it plain as Old Lady Killigrew could, I reckon, even standing outside with the window closed. And that night, I said to Pete, what's a Pearl Harbor? And Pete said, hush. And it evoked this image of these two farm boys eavesdropping on a neighbor's radio when the Pearl Harbor announcement was made. And it just, I went, holy crap. And I sat down. And by the time I was finished reading it, I was sitting there in a puddle of tears. And I said, is it possible that I could just walk into the library and pick the first book and the first story? And like, so I may have read a couple other stories, but, you know, and quit halfway through because they were nowhere as interesting or meaningful to me. And I said, okay, I'm going to check this book out. And that was the beginning of Two Soldiers. And I adapted it and went to North Carolina and shot it. And it worked out pretty well.
I would say so. It's a beautiful film, and it's kind of serendipitous that Saving Private Ryan was on the brain, and now we're going to talk to you a lot about Greyhound, of course, written and starring Tom Hanks. So I think Jay has that first question.
Yeah, that's amazing. Bring you and Tom Hanks and Dale Dye worked on that, and you worked with him as well.
Oh yeah, I got my souvenir from the film. I asked the prop guy to give me an extra captain's helmet.
Nice.
And, And I had Tom sign one side of the helmet and Dale Dye sign the other. It's my Saving Private Ryan helmet.
That's awesome. kind of changing gears, but not. But your directorial debut, Get Low, had a budget of like $7 million-ish. It was released in 2009. 11 years later, you're given a budget of $50 million for a Tom Hanks World War II epic. What was the reason you had this 11-year gap in between your freshman and sophomore directorial efforts, and what led you from Get Low to Greyhound?
Well, it wasn't really that much time, because you start working on Greyhound. I was working on Greyhound in 2016. So, and we spent a year moving around the world with Get Low. So just numerically speaking, it wasn't quite that big a gap. On the other hand, it was probably due to, you know, I'm very selective about the work I choose. I'm not really a journeyman when it comes to this work. If I don't feel something for the movie, I don't have any gas in the tank, I can't really function. It's, as you guys probably know, there's a whole range of films out there. Some of them are inspiring, some of them not so much. And I don't really know how to make a movie that I wouldn't want to see myself. So that probably contributed to a lot of it in terms of that gap you're talking about. And then I also shoot commercials and direct commercials and these kinds of things. And I helped some of my friends on other projects to fill the time. And then along came the Tom Hanks project, and obviously that pulled me out of my shell. So, that's pretty much what accounts for all that.
Yeah. There were some great scenes in Greyhound too, that just felt like Hanks' character was moving throughout the ship, and he's giving orders and receiving reports and searching for U-boats and so on. But the way the dialogue is delivered, it really felt like all those actors were so well-versed in Navy jargon, and it helped the tension really become elevated in those scenes, the way that the dialogue was delivered and the sounds of the music score that you had. And that was all before you even got your first glimpse of the U-boat, which should be the main, you know, antagonist of this entire film. Where'd you find inspiration for the scenes that you shot like that? It was reminiscent of some films that, I've previously seen, but you know, I wanted to get your take on why, how and why you built the tension in a way, before even seeing the U-boat for the first time.
Well, that was Tom's, you know, Tom is the screenwriter. That was his original vision. Every movie starts with a screenplay, whether it's Tom Hanks or not. And ideally the screenplay is a blueprint, has a point of view, and maps out the kind of story it wants to tell in the way it wants to tell it. And so what you're describing was a big part of what Tom, the screenwriter, was trying to do with that screenplay, that adaptation of the book. As you know, it's based on C.S. Forrester's The Good Shepherd. And which concentrates on very heavily on the point of view of Captain Krause. Because the whole movie is the whole point of the movie, and Tom's goal, he said from the start, he said, I want to make the perfect 90-minute procedural thriller. I think a lot of people go into this movie expecting Saving Private Ryan Part 2 or Saving Private Ryan on the Sea. But Tom was not interested in doing repeating himself or repeating anyone else. And he wanted to find a new way into a new part of the war. And this book was a real sort of close character study, an examination of one man moving through one harrowing experience. And the appeal of it was to find a way in the screenplay to tell his very internal story through the process, which translated to screenwriting and ultimately to filmmaking as a very subjective thing. We're gonna experience this through one person's, we're gonna walk in one person's shoes, one person's slippers, as the case may be. And so that meant that if you're a captain moving through all of this with the uncertainty and equipment that's not entirely reliable and a crew behind you that's terrified and looking to you for answers, that story lives with him on the bridge. That's the emotional element that you're exploring, that you're, that's the way in for the audience, is the unknown, is, you know, how do you find a sub under the water with these old pieces of equipment with, by bouncing sound off of it. Because when you look out the front portal, all you see is the sea. And so cutting to a U-boat too quickly, you know, kind of kills your appreciation or your understanding of how difficult that is and how blind you're flying, right, as a captain. So it's all about perspective. And then, of course, once the audience has been through the ringer on that, then the U-boats start to take a more active place in the narrative. Then they start to show their dorsal fins, so to speak. And that began with Tom's screenplay. In fact, his original screenplay was much, I don't think you saw three U-boats in the whole movie. Mm-hmm. Because he wanted to carry on that sense of an unseen enemy. And of course, every time people talk about making a horror movie, everyone goes to Jaws.
Yep.
You know, and the catchphrase is, the shark is scarier if you don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know it's Absolutely. Out there, but you don't see it. So there was a little bit of that designed into the film.
Yeah, absolutely. And also another aspect of the U-boats I loved was just those little bits of almost taunting that the gray wolf does in the midst of that, because quite honestly, it's just like what you just described about, you know, everybody being so tense and so nervous, is it's so apparent there from the very first moment we get on that boat. And yeah, then you've got this unseen enemy that can kill all of you in an instant, telling you, hey, we're going to kill you. Ha ha ha. And it was just like, it made me so nervous for everybody on that ship. But you know, sometimes in films of this nature where there, you know, there's battles being fought on the water in the sky, it's easy as a viewer to kind of get lost in that action. But in this movie, I just felt like I always knew where the characters were on the ship, where the ship was in conjunction with the U-boats. So as a director, like, how do you even go about making scenes like this, which are like littered throughout the movie, that make them so they're easily digestible for the audience? Like, how do you keep it all straight when you're filming it?
That's a good question. And it was the biggest challenge of my career, frankly, because you know, when you think, let's say a director has a scene to shoot, and it's somebody walks into a lawyer's office, sits down, talks to the lawyer about, you know, the case, they shake hands, and then they exit, right? Well, you benefit from the audience understanding the concept of a lawyer's office. There's mm-hmm. a door, there's two chairs that are usually sitting across from each other, and all I have to do is kind of show a wide shot to establish, hey, look, you're in a lawyer's office. And then everyone takes for granted the geography of that room, stuffs it away in their back pocket. And without realizing it, that's the filmmaker acquainting you with the geography of the scene so that you can get inside of it and understand it. And spatially. But the problem with Greyhound is that, you know, now imagine a lawyer's office where there are no walls. You know, there's the window used to be behind the lawyer, so I knew I was looking that way. And the bookshelves used to be behind his client when I'm looking that way. But now imagine the client and the lawyer are floating and sailing around the room, and there's no anchor point visually to, you know, and not, you know, so not, now the lawyer's floating, the desk is floating. And now you add that the way the desk floats and the way the lawyer is floating and the way the client is floating is part of the story. You have to understand how they're floating, so that the audience can, you know, track along, you know, with the battle. We called it tactical awareness. You know, how much tactical awareness does the audience need to be invested in the tactical drama? You know, that opening scene, I'll give you a good example. That opening scene where he's chasing the first U-boat, the big long one that we drag out for tension. You know.
Right, right.
I came up with the idea, because it's an unseen U-boat, and people wouldn't know how to extrapolate, you know, port 001. They wouldn't know what that means, even though it's, you know, 1 degree off the port bow. They wouldn't know that. So I came up with the concept that Krauss would stare out the window, draw a center line down the middle of the ship. And as the submarine moved from one side of his bow to another, unseen under the water, I would stage it so that Tom would literally shift. When the U-boat would shift the port side of his bow, he would walk across the cabin and look at it out a port side window. And then we'd cut to his point of view of the patch of water under which the U-boat was sailing, right? And then he'd get a reading, you know, starboard 005, and he'd say, right rudder. And then you'd see him move to the right side of the bow. And then we'd cut to that patch of water off the starboard side of his bow. And that hopefully underneath it, the audience is being sort of educated spatially just by the body movement and the gestures that, you know, the captain moving back and forth gives you a sense of the spatial relationships of this unseen mouse that we're chasing. Right. And that's just one example of how you're trying to subtextually and subconsciously communicate visually with an audience. And then at other times it's about seeing enough. It's about, you know, cutting up wide to see a God's eye point of view so that you can, you know, it's like cutting to the wide shot of the lawyer's office so that people are oriented and now you can go in and find the details without being disoriented. So it was a real challenge. It was a good question because it was the hardest part of the movie. And of course, we shot all the stuff of Tom looking at all this stuff. But when we wrapped on day 35 of the original shoot, none of what he was looking at existed. So now you go into the editing room and you've got all these shots where he says, oh my gosh, he's looking through the binoculars, and you have to cut to a blank screen with a slug, a title in it. And that's the beginning of creating what we call post-visualization, where a computer puts together a rough animation of what's happening out there. And that is then later going to inspire the visual effects company to fill it out into something more vivid and realistic. And so when you're making the movie, the biggest job is making sure that the actors, Tom specifically, but everyone else engaged in the battle, understand what's going on out there, have their own unique eye lines and marks to look at, so that when you do connect that footage later to what they're reacting to, the two blend together seamlessly. And it was a big job.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a quick follow-up on that, like, I think that first scene is so tense, not just because of the amazing camera work and such, but also that score by Blake Neely is just so tense throughout this whole movie. I mean, what was it like? I mean, like, obviously, if people don't know, he's just a prolific, you know, music scorer for television, did all those CW superhero shows. But like, what was it like when you first got to hear that music put together with this footage? And did that just kind of bring it all circle there?
Yeah, it's always fun when the movie comes to life. Music, sound, any of that stuff. You know, even filmmakers get to the point where they're bringing their movie to life and they giggle and they say, oh my gosh, it's a movie. Right. And so, yeah, that was a lot of fun. And I think, you know, in combination with the pings, you know, the sort of metronome quality of the pings and that kind of thing, it was a real barn burner.
Another really important aspect of your film and many films is going to be the visual effects and the CGI that goes into it. And in a lot of ways, the visuals can kind of make or break a film. If the CGI seems out of place, it can take you out of the story. But your film, Greyhound, was so visually stunning. And you never lost sight of the story. And I know that you got your start in cinematography and visual effects, and that's something that's important to you. How do you go about making sure that your visuals match your story?
Well, it all starts with a philosophy. You decide what the visual language of the movie is going to be. And in this case, it was the whole movie's handheld, and we wanted all the visual effects to feel like they were actually photographed on the open water, which means that, you know, because visual effects are infinite, you can do whatever you want. You know, the camera can fly across the water and through a portal and down in, you know, down inside the ship and back out again if you want to. So the first step is to ground the visual effects in a sense of realism. And the way we tried to achieve that is to always create cameras in our visual effects that felt like the same cameras you'd or scenarios you'd have if you went out onto the water. We would take two digital ships and float them next to each other, like a camera ship would if it was out in the ocean. And you put a digital camera on your camera ship and you shoot your picture ship from it. And then you move both of those ships in, you know, you recreate the chaos of the water and the unpredictability of the water. You know, so you're taking a perfect environment where you can do anything, and you're limiting what you can do and how you can do it to those methods and scenarios that would be involved if you actually did go out and do it. So that before you even worry about whether the water looks real or not, the shot itself is grounded conceptually in a photorealistic way. And then like any other movie at that point, now it's about matching the light and the texture. And, you know, that's the craft of visual effects is, you know, how do I create realism from computer numbers? And, you know, and any film with visual effects, that it's an army of people massaging images and colors and little elements, and this needs a little bit more water. This needs a little more atmosphere. This needs, or that bow splash isn't working. You know, we got to do something about that. And, you know, these visual effects don't come by pressing a button. They come, it's like painting a painting. You know, most movies will spend 3 to 8 months or even longer just going in and looking at single shots day after day after day with crews and teams of artists in the background, massaging each element and how they come together until finally you throw it up on the screen. You go, okay, I think that works now. And based on the amount of money you have, the amount of time you have, some movies are more successful than others in that process. And even within your own film, some shots are more successful than others. And it was a big challenge on Greyhound. Most people will look at the movie and think we're one of those big Hollywood budget movies. Well, we weren't. You know, we had about $40 million. And, you know, compared to a movie like Titanic at the time, which probably was $250 million, and, you know, In the Heart of the Sea, A Master and the Commander, those are all above $100 million. And we had half that. We had the same amount of work to do and half the money and half the time. So, you know, you do the best with what you can, but the real trick is the best way to make people believe your visual effects is that they're so caught up in the story, they're not looking at them. Right. So it's a lot, you know, so it's actually easier. Visual effects are easier in movies that are more entertaining, because, you know, they go by without being noticed or analyzed or scrutinized as closely. So the better the movie you make, the more seamless the audience will feel as though those visual effects are being woven in.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And like I said, we all loved it. But my question, so I'm on the podcast. I kind of weaseled my way in with these guys by saying I'm a veteran, Army. So you were in all that Navy jargon, and I was totally lost just because I don't know Navy. I don't speak Navy. But I got in because I said, hey, what if we get some veterans together and we look at war movies, you know, periodically and give a veteran perspective on those. But that leads me to my question. What elements do you think make for a good war movie?
What elements make for a good war movie? That's a tough question to answer because the rules for a good movie are the same for any movie, whether it's a war movie or not. I guess the closest, best way to answer your question for me anyway would be that if you're going to farm, if you're going to mine the subject of war for a film, you kind of owe it to history and the men who really lived it to be as faithful to the experience as you can. In other words, you can play in their sandbox. It belongs to them. You can play in their sandbox as long as you follow the rules, so to speak. And the rules are, show it the way it happened. Don't embellish and don't have enough respect for the men and what they did to understand the way they did it and the challenges of the way they did it and let that be a part of the drama. Otherwise, all of those contributions, you're not properly representing those contributions. So, you know, that's where a tech advisor or your own studies and on authenticity and the way I work very hard to understand all the equipment and the knobs and the protocol and the communications so that we could do right by the challenges, just the procedural challenges, you know, the sort of analog way that they had to communicate and the analog way they had to fight the enemy. The movie was procedural. It was built on a lot of these things. It was, you know, a sneeze in the middle of people communicating with each other could cost you precious seconds. And so we mine drama out of that, but you can't appreciate that drama. Can't appreciate the deadly nature of a sneeze, unless you understand the challenges of the way communications worked. And that was one of the challenges and one of the fun parts about the movie was trying to get inside that way of life for those men and dramatize it and make it a part of the movie rather than just background noise.
Yeah, that's a fantastic answer because I even wrote what I thought make up a good war movie. And you basically said what I did, but much, much better and much, much smarter.
I did have the advantage of a little bit more time and research on the subject than you did. So
that's fair. one thing I found very impressive is, you know, this movie has a PG-13 rating, which you don't see all that often with war films. I always prefer that the war movies, military movies show kind of the horror side of it, you know, that they have a bit of an anti-war message or more just not to glorify war. Right. But I thought it was really impressive that you didn't use gore or some of the stuff we have a tendency to see. But I felt like you still showed that horror by having very high and very extended levels of stress. And I mean that absolutely positively. I felt like I had 5 minutes at the beginning and 5 minutes at the end where my fingers weren't digging into the armchair on my chair. So, I mean, was that your intent, while making this and, you know,
yeah,
I'll just let you take the reins.
Yeah, no, it's, the whole concept, as I mentioned, Tom wanted an experience. He wanted to communicate the story through experience. he didn't, you know, wasn't a movie where people pull out pictures of their family back home and speak a soliloquy on the horrors of war, or, you know, there was no, the movie doesn't announce its ideas. The movie doesn't announce its theme. It's the Tom's aspiration was to make a movie so intense and so burdensome on this man, happening with his first command and all the lives under his, in his, you know, in his responsibility, and the tactical dilemmas and the no-win scenarios and the loss of life and moving past, you know, one tragedy to try and stop another, that if you could just exhaust the audience with the mental stress and the emotional stress, that that the theme of the film would rise out of just experiencing it through his eyes, right? And that translated to creating as visceral and experiential movie experience as possible. So hopefully the audience is exhausted as he is, and when he lays down to bed, you're like right there with him, you know, trying, you know, thanking your lucky stars that you can sit back on your sofa with your popcorn and finally relax. And that was what the movie was designed to be. So even the structure, even the nonstop nature of it, is meant to emulate that sense of the stress through this 72-hour period, never letting up, you know, barely a chance to rest your torso by leaning against the wall before someone taps you on the shoulder with another piece of information. That's the whole thing's designed to do. It's a unique movie. It's a bit experimental. It's not a classic war drama. It's meant to beam you aboard the USS Keeling with very little information. It's meant for you to look around and go, what the hell is this? Right? It's, you're supposed to feel disoriented, uncomfortable. I don't understand what this is and how that, I don't get what they're doing or saying. And then our job was to keep bombarding you with it, force you to engage in this environment and listen, learn, and then pick up enough that you suddenly begin to say, oh, okay, I see how this works. Oh, holy cow. You know, and slowly you get reeled in, and by being very authentic with the way a pilot house plays itself out, you have a kind of respect. You're like, I feel like I'm here. I might not understand everything just yet, but I feel like I'm here, and this is really nerve-wracking to be a part of this bunch of guys. And that was the mantra, and that was the drama, by placing you in it.
I think you nailed it. I like how you said kind of experimental. I told my wife, watched it with me. She is not a big movie. She maybe watches five movies over and over, and that's, I mean, she's not into movies. But I said we're gonna watch this tonight, and I told her I would tell you this. She said, after this movie, she said, I don't know how you're going to sleep. I can't possibly go to sleep after that movie. But I told her, I said, that was a very taut, right? About 90 minutes, very tight movie. I said, you got the absolute point across that you wanted to in the time frame that the movie was covered. It didn't feel like anything was missed. But I told her that. I said, this didn't feel like too many war movies that I've seen. So I like you use that term, experimental. But one other quick question. We mentioned his name earlier. I don't know if you may know, we interviewed, Captain Dale Dye, just about a week and a half ago, talked to him for a good long while. I just wanted to check, see what you thought. What was it like working with him, and what did he bring, to the experience of directing Greyhound?
Captain Dale Dye.
Really good.
That's a perfect impression.
Now listen up, boys. He's a legend. I'm sure he was working long before Platoon, but that was, you know, you know, Forrest Gump, Saving Private Ryan. I think I've nailed a few of his credits there. But he's, even if you don't know his credits, you know of him. And, you know, like I said, I was a huge Saving Private Ryan fan, and that Normandy Beach assault, was, you know, is going to live for a long time as the state of the art in combat photography. And just knowing that he was in the background of that, helping render it gives, you know, makes him the king of what he does. And then, you know, he came up with this concept of immersing a cast into a boot camp, trying to give them a small taste of, you know, I think he takes them out into the woods for 5 days and makes them live the conditions and sleep the conditions and starve the conditions, and never assuming that you could ever recreate what it was really like, but trying to get the actors close enough to the way of life, the experience, the discomfort and the fear and the uncertainty, so that they as actors now have some experience of their own that they lived, that they can call back on, right? They can touch, they got a touchstone, because that's the actor's craft, is to reach back into their own life experience, find some meaning in their own lives that they can put into their fictional work and lend it a sense of veracity. And that's what he does for actors. And he did something similar on Greyhound, where the boys slept in the bunks. I just had a Zoom chat with a bunch of the younger cast that filled out the bridge a few days ago. And I asked them what their favorite, you know, who has the best story during, you know, boot camp with Dale. And one of them piped in and talked about how Dale woke him up and with a general quarters alarm in the middle of the night. And he was sleeping in the top bunk, and he leaned up fast and he banged his head against the, you know, the steel rafter above him. And, you know, and that's just pretty much it right there. Now that kid is now, he's no longer a rookie, right? Now, when he's standing on my set, you know, in the background, and he's got some experience with what it means to be on this ship. And he, you know, now when he moves through a doorway in the background of my shot or something like that, he's thinking a little harder about the way to move around this ship. Right. And he now feels like he's lived in it. He's got the same sort of awareness of the steel ship around him that or a bit of it anyway, that a real sailor would have. And this stuff adds up. I know it sounds a little esoteric, but this kind of experience and moving, you know, try, you know, I don't care how good an athlete you are, try running up the steps of a destroyer from one level to another for the first time, and you'll need some practice. Whereas these sailors, they did it without even looking at the steps. And so now how do you recreate that verisimilitude with a bunch of young athletic men who've never stood on a destroyer? Well, you run them around the destroyer for a week. You know, you force them to get to know the ship they're going to be standing on. And then that gets woven into the fabric of the photography. And that's Dale's art. And that's his genius. Is the ability to do that for a war movie.
I have two last questions for you. And one might be a little bit silly here. We don't get too many Central Illinois filmmakers. We had Brenda Chapman, who's from Beeson, Illinois. We spoke to her and just loved that conversation, but it's really cool to have people from this area, Central Illinois, that are on. But here's a less than serious question, but there probably is a right answer to this.
Okay.
You grew up in Springfield and in Peoria. Horseshoes or Avantes? What are you picking? Which one is your go-to out of those two?
Oh, that's easy. Avantes by far.
Okay.
Condola. Gondola with mayonnaise and a Diet Dr. Pepper, for sure.
All right. All right, you were quick on that one. So my last question, of course, Greyhound is available on Apple TV. We'd encourage everyone to go out and watch this film. It is fantastic and well worth the subscription fee for that month to be able to watch this film. And there's a lot of other really good original content on Apple TV as well. But of course, much like all of America, we adore Tom Hanks here at the Front Row. And so just wondering about that working relationship, what it's like to work with Tom on that level and sort of how that came to be.
The script came to me through my agent. Tom and I are at the same agency here in LA called CAA, Creative Artists Agency. And Tom had written it like a decade ago, and it had a few early iterations. You know, they were playing with how they wanted to make it maybe for a long time and never found the right time for Tom or the right mix of elements that they felt comfortable with as a production company. You know, Tom is partners with Gary Getzman at a company called Plato, and they're the ones who make these legendary miniseries we all love, Band of Brothers and Pacific, and they're about to make a new one, Masters of the Air at Apple. Big, monstrous, huge World War II epic miniseries, the third of their trilogy. And so the script came, and, you know, you get, and you read a lot of scripts as a client. You know, you're fishing around for your next opportunity, and not every opportunity you pursue ends up happening. And along came Tom's script, and I read it and I saw what he was trying to do. It, you know, as you guys know, it's a very unique way into a war story. And I felt like I knew what he was trying to do. And then I noticed that he wrote it. And, you know, I've told you my story about two soldiers, which was this really special project in my life, in my career, it was more meaningful than just the next thing to do, right? It was a turning point. It was me doing something for myself. And then I realized, wow, what if this is kind of Tom's two soldiers? What if, you know, no one thinks of Tom as someone, everyone thinks he's done it all, but, you know, artists are always trying to try new things and challenge themselves Even people like Tom Hanks want to challenge themselves and do something different that belongs to them. And I thought, wow, it'd be one thing to make a Tom Hanks movie, but if this is a special project, if this is uniquely meaningful to him in some way, then that would be a completely kind of different working relationship with someone than just hiring Tom Hanks to be in your movie, right? You're going to get the whole package. You're going to be involved in get to know his company and get to know Tom as a producer. And so that appealed to me. And that's the way it turned out to be. And, you know, in the early stages, Tom would be the writer and we'd work together as director writer. And then we got to the set and Tom became Tom the actor. And then we got to post-production and went back to Tom, the producer, and producers, especially big producers, have a lot of influence over the way a movie comes together in post-production. So he was very involved in that as well, along with his partner. It was a sort of team effort. So I got to work with Tom through all of these phases instead of just wrapping him out as an actor and thanking him for being in my film. And that excited me because that dates back to the whole thing I told you earlier, you know, the idea of finding somebody next door willing to dig a Hogan's Heroes tunnel with you, you know, and hide from your parents underground or something like that. There's a sort of a band of gypsies quality that makes this business fun. Right. And that's what it turned out to be.
That's great. Craig said that he had the last fun question, but I actually have the last fun question. I actually thought this is what he was going to ask you. Are you a Cardinals fan or a Cubs fan?
I'll tell you what I am. I'm a fan of Cubs-Cardinals games.
That's right. That's right. Perfect. That's a great diplomatic way to answer that question.
Craig literally said half of our audience is going to hate him when he asks that question, and you found the answer to prevent that from happening.
This isn't my first barbecue.
Oh, that was wonderful. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to hang out with us, talk about a little bit of your past work, but really dig into Greyhound with us. And I just want to ask, Aaron, do you have anything down the chute you want to talk about, give a shout out to?
You mean in terms of projects?
Yeah, project, anything you got.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to getting to the point where I can come back to Springfield, see my folks. I'm trying, you know, the business has changed, right? Because everything's pushed down the road, there's a cloud of stasis hanging over the industry because there's so much uncertainty. No one understands the rhythms of the future. No one can predict the future, but usually you can kind of predict the rhythms of the future, but we don't even know that. And so it's kind of changed the whole industry's day-to-day heartbeat. But even so, inside of that, I've got a project that recently went that we packaged together with Anne Hathaway and Bill Murray and Robert Duvall from Get Low, in a smaller sort of independent drama called Bums Rush that my agency has took out on the market recently with the Cannes market, the virtual Cannes. You know, it's a market where you'd normally go to France and peddle your project, but it had to occur virtually online this year. And that's an exciting project. But you know, one of several, that's the way it works in this business. You put the steaks and the sausages on the grill and you put the hot dogs over here. And depending on how the coals burn, you know, one's ready before the other. This business is like going down the rapids. You know, you can't control the current, but you do have a paddle. Some of it happens just because of the flow of the business, and some of it happens because you're steering furiously. And then you add the pandemic on top of that, and it's hard to say. But we're all in Hollywood looking forward to getting back to work and providing everybody with that entertainment we need. It's nice. It's actually been kind of nice. You know, you're not curing cancer when you work as a filmmaker, but you can entertain and you can, you know, make people dream for a couple hours. And knowing that, you know, specifically Greyhound, but knowing everybody else that does what they love out here has been, you know, the idea that people are stuck in their homes turning to your work to find some entertainment or to pass the time a little bit easier. It's a nice feeling because you wouldn't normally get to contribute in that regard. You're mainly making movies for people to go out and see on the weekend for fun, but it feels right now like people are really turning to their content and their TVs, their favorite shows, their favorite characters, their favorite stories to help them get through it. And that's a nice feeling. So we'll be back to work as soon as we can to continue on.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with the general apathy that I think a lot of us are feeling. Yeah. I think movies and television shows right now are that pick-me-up that we all have access to. And I'm just very glad we got to watch Greyhound, talk about Greyhound. And I just want to, on behalf of everybody at the Front Row Network, I just want to give a huge thank you to you. And so everybody knows Academy Award-winning director Aaron Schneider with his new film, Greyhound. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure to be here.
All right. That was a fantastic discussion we just had. I hope everybody out there in podcast land enjoyed it. Craig, what did you think? How do you think that went?
You know, it's just really remarkable to talk to him about all of the specifics and the technical aspects that go into directing. He had that really great story about how he thought the audience might be confused as to where the U-boat was, and he didn't want to have to necessarily describe all those nautical terms and how all that is done. So he kind of used Tom Hanks's position on the boat as a way to kind of map and show you where the U-boat was at all times. I mean, just things like that, you can see that he really loves his craft and talks so specifically about the visual effects and cinematography work that he did in his past. And he's from Central Illinois. I think that is just so cool that we have an Oscar winner that was born here in Springfield that loves Springfield and comes back often. It's just a really neat piece of Springfield zeitgeist and history to have, and just a wonderful opportunity to be able to interview him.
Yeah, you could definitely hear his engineering brain. He mentioned he went to school for that, and you could hear his engineering brain working through some of those scenes. Jeremy, what'd you think?
Yeah, absolutely. This movie was just so damn good. And you know, you watch it and you just like, I can't even wrap my head around how you begin to film something like this movie. And just, you know, getting all of the practicality, but also keeping everything in line. That was the answer that just blew me away the most is, you know, how you keep it all straight in your head. And, you know, also just the fascination of, you're working with Tom Hanks, which is, you know, crazy enough on its own, but then he wrote the damn thing too. And so you're dealing with your star that is your writer. And I just, you know, like that was just a fascinating aspect of all of this too. But yeah, he's a great storyteller there. The story about meeting Billy Crystal and then him, Billy Crystal, being the host of on the night he won his Oscar. Like that's just serendipity right there, all over the place. Yeah, and I just want to encourage everyone, if you haven't seen the movie yet, I mean, it's well worth the $5 subscription to Apple TV. It is truly a great experience of a film. The score is tight. It just ratchets up the action right away, and it does not stop. And you are just there feeling all of it. So, yeah, I think this is one of my favorite war movies writ large that I've seen in quite some time.
Yeah, I would suggest not watching it late at night because of an hour and a half movie, about an hour and 20 minutes of it, your heart is beating out of your chest.
Right.
Because the stress is just slowly ratcheted up the whole entire time.
That's everybody. Everybody in the movie is just so tense the whole time. And I mean, of course they would be. There's freaking murder boats all around them.
And that poor guy just trying to get him food to feed him during this whole thing. I mean, that was such an interesting character too, to highlight and spotlight. Like,
yeah.
And it shows you the passage of time in a way that I thought was really interesting because he keeps trying to bring him food. Just some really intelligent things that happen throughout this entire film. And it means that it's well written by Tom Hanks, but obviously very well directed by Aaron as well. And it's just so remarkable that we had the chance and opportunity to speak with him today.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of attention to detail to this movie too. The funeral scene in particular, there's some a moment that is grotesque and sad all at the same time in this funeral scene that is an attention to detail that you just don't get in every film. And it's just those little things that add up all throughout this movie to make it really, really amazing. And I'm so happy we got to talk to the guy who made it all happen.
Yeah, that was great. You guys got anything else coming up in the near future? Craig, you got anything?
Over on the Beyond the Mouse feed, we are going to have a special interview with Kay from the Walt Disney Hometown Museum. We're excited about that because she talks all about Marceline, Missouri, which isn't too far away here from Springfield, Illinois. And that's where Walt spent a lot of his youth and really developed a sense of what he would become in many years to become after Marceline. So really cool. So check out that feed and also follow that feed on Instagram. We're doing a lot more on Instagram over there. So go to Beyond the Mouse Pod on Instagram and have some fun with us.
All right, Jeremy, you got anything coming up?
Yeah, we will be, Sarah and I on Are You Afraid of the Podcast, we'll be ending season 3 with the tale of the dangerous soup. Yeah, it's a lot better than it sounds. It's not exactly the scariest title of all time, but it's a damn good episode, all about people who have to experience what scares them most in an utterly terrifying way. So, you know, what can I say? Early 90s kids Nickelodeon was a little more edgy than a lot of us remember. So we're going to be closing out season 3 of Are You Afraid of the Dark with that episode. And then we're going to be going right into season 4 with the tale of the Renegade Virus. So that's what we're doing there.
I believed.
Yeah, exactly. and also just want to really quickly plug that I started doing the Rundown video series on the Front Row Network page, which is literally every Monday. Just a quick 2 to 3 minute video, just recapping all the biggest news stories you might have missed in the world of movies, TVs, music, everything. So just check that out every Monday on the Front Row Network page.
Yeah, and over at Front Row Flashbacks, next month we've decided we're going to do for its 40th birthday, we're gonna take a look at the long-lasting effects of Caddyshack. And
nice.
Me and Ryan, and we're going to have a special guest, former caddy, Aaron McCabe, is going to join us on nice. For that one. So
she was
we're
a
looking
caddy?
Forward to that.
That's awesome.
She was a caddy. So I wonder if I doubt it's quite as crazy as it was in the 70s.
The layers of her personality are just amazing to me.
That's why she's the Jane of all trades on the show.
That is true.
All right. Where can they find us, Craig?
Yeah, so you can find the Front Row Network, of course, on nprillinois.org. You can also find us on social media. Just search for the Front Row Network, or you can search us on Twitter. Front Row Review is with a Z. And just always reach out to us and let us know what you think about the show. Make sure to also leave a rating. I don't think we ask you to do that enough, but we just want you to leave a rating on iTunes or whatever podcast app you're listening to. That just gives more exposure to other people wanting to listen to the show as well. And we appreciate all of the love that you send our way.
All right, for everybody out there, this is Jay Hoffman,
Jeremy Gechner,
and Craig McFarland,
and we'll see you in the Front Row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter.